This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Will has never been outside, at least not since he can remember, and Will has certainly never gotten to know anyone other than his mother. Diane is a fiercely loving yet wildly eccentric agoraphobic mother who drowns in panic at the thought of opening the front door. The world Will and Diane inhabit is rich and loving, full of art, experiments and music, but it's confined to their small house in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
Author Michael Christie's debut novel, If I Fall, If I Die, explores the new worlds created when a son grows out of his agoraphobic mother's safety net. Michael is also the award-winning author of an earlier collection of short stories set in and around Vancouver's downtown east side. That's called The Beggar's Garden. If I Fall, If I Die is his first novel. I spoke with Michael Christie earlier this week.
Michael, you write on page 42 and you're talking about Diane. Of course she'd read books, an entire shelf's worth. Agoraphobia, that word, one thing to call it. And then further down the page, you write, because here was the ruthless truth, a truth that had cornered her like an animal and would never free her from her cage. To fight panic is to panic. Now, Diane's agoraphobia is pretty carefully portrayed, I would say, in your book, Michael. How did you enter into the depths of that experience?
Two ways. The first way was kind of involuntary, and that was my mom was agoraphobic. While I was growing up, although her illness was different in its sort of manifestation than my character Diane's. I mean, I grew up in a house, as anyone who grows up in a family with a mentally ill parent, I grew up trying to figure her out and sort of trying to understand, you know, why she couldn't drive or why she couldn't take vacations and things like that. So I grew up sort of in a situation, you know, that instilled in me this sort of great interest in the illness itself and then also in mental illness in general. And then the second thing, I mean, the way that I prepared at least to write Diane was I read a whole ton of memoirs written by people suffering from the illness. My mom passed away in 2008, and I after that I sort of set out to write this book. Maybe, I'm not sure, I guess maybe as a way of understanding her, maybe as a way of grieving, you know, all of those are quite possible. So that aspect, that understanding of, you know, what it really feels like to suffer from something like this, I needed to get right because I knew that if I blew it, I would be doing her a disservice and my own work a disservice. So I did a ton of research, and it's been something I've been thinking about my whole life.
Your character, Will, changes in his understanding and his response to his mother's agoraphobia. Later in the book, you write the following about Will. Some part of him turned inside out. All the pity and compassion and responsibility he'd once felt for her had finally compacted into a molten core of disgust. The truth was, she could leave any time she wanted, except she didn't care to, because she was selfish. Tell us more about Will's evolving understanding of his mother's agoraphobic condition through the course of the book.
You know, that was maybe one of the darker points for Will, you know, throughout his journey in the book. And he begins the story as, you know, kind of just enamored with his mom and really doesn't, you know, knows that she's teetering on the edge of something, but is not really too concerned. And it isn't until he sort of ventures outside, they spend most of their time at home, that he ventures outside that he sort of starts to put together the fact that he's growing up in a very strange situation and that his mom, you know, can't do things that other parents can do and all that. And so that passage is really emblematic of all of us. I think anybody growing up, there's a kind of point where you realize your parents are fallible, or you realize that you don't want to be like them, and you almost define yourself in a way as, you know, as that, as like, I want to be anything other than what my parents are. And I think that's a very important sort of step in adolescence and building this wall between us and our parents that allows us to forge independence.
You work a lot with the outside and inside, I guess you might say, metaphors and realities in the book. when Will, for example, more fully enters the outside, it's clear that once he arrives there in everyday life, he's actually an outsider. And I was struck by this kind of play of outsider and insider, both outside and inside. Tell us about your use of those. They're very powerful words, about your use of those words in the book.
They really are, and it became sort of this guiding metaphor for me, you know, as I was working. And it's this, the words are capitalized in the book as well to sort of give them this heightened significance, obviously, literally, to people who spend their time inside, and, you know, the outside is very foreign to them. But then also, I mean, there's a lot of thoughts going on inside a person's body and changes inside your body and outside your body and, you know, the inside the house versus out in the city. And there's like, there's all of these resonances that I kind of try to set up throughout the book. I mean, you know, even more than just the house, that boundary, the doorway of the house being the boundary between the inside and the outside. So it's something that I find really profoundly interesting just in my own life. You know, the distinction that the human being makes between inside space and outside space is just so fundamental to our being. It's very powerful. So, you know, I think I unconsciously and consciously sort of built it into the fabric of the book.
On page 82, you write, Will had imagined there'd be less fear outside, but everyone was afraid all the time of failure, humiliation, harm, though he was still working out in what order. I like that line. But you also expanded on this wider spread fear in your short essay in the Washington Post recently, which you called We're All Agoraphobics Now. I'm wondering if you could just speak more about this notion of a wider fear in society.
I mean, it's something that's been, really, you know, sort of building in me for the last while. And, I've become a father in the last 5 years, and I've found my own sort of awareness of the dangers of the world heightened. But then also, I mean, I think fear is this, it's almost this cultural currency now. And you know, media organizations and bloggers and everybody has sort of figured out that fear kind of trumps everything. And it's this incredibly powerful motivating force. A lot of the fear mongering is unjustified. Is, you know, like crime rates are actually falling, and have been falling for a long time, and yet our media gives us this perception that, you know, there are killers stalking the, you know, our yards at night, which is, you know, it's absurd. And so I think people are very motivated by fear, and I think, you know, Will's observation that he found a ton of fear outside is very true. And I think, you know, there are people who are, you know, almost entirely motivated by fear. Fear, you know, people who work because they're afraid of being broke, or people who, you know, have addiction issues because they're afraid of actually sort of facing themselves for any period of time. And so, you know, I think everyone is afraid of many, many things. It's something that I think about a lot, and it's sort of something that Will and I both see everywhere.
You also explore the lack of fear that can be present through the character, primarily the character Jonah. And you wrote the following, Jonah didn't seem to fear anything. And later on the schoolyard, Jonah was untouchable, like a hockey referee who never blew his whistle. Tell us about that character of Jonah and his role in the book, I guess, in a general sense, but his importance to you as a writer.
Jonah arrives very, you know, in one of those moments that writers, you know, really cherish. And, you know, he just came to me in an instant, and I just knew him right away. And he's based on friends I had growing up. Jonah's an Aboriginal boy who's, you know, very creative, but is also shut down in many ways because he has grown up without parents, and he's growing up in a society that is very dismissive of him. And he's learned to sort of adapt to it in his way. He's also very sweet and very talented and very, you know, very, in many ways, he's angry. Rightfully so, I would say. Jonah is kind of Will's model. Like, Will, you know, Will sees him and sort of just starts to sort of copy him. You know, he introduces Will to skateboarding. He, you know, is a better artist than Will, and he has sort of a more reasonable take. Like, if Will is the Will has a very sort of naive view of the world and the outside world particularly. Jonah understands it on a fundamental level. Unfortunately, he understands that it's stacked against him. He understands that, you know, he understands the limitations that he's facing. And they form this very kind of interesting duo in the book where they, you know, they're sort of a counterpoint to each other. I think, and it turns out in the end, I don't think Jonah is entirely fearless, because I don't think anyone is. It's just that some people manage to mask their fear or to deal with it in ways that aren't apparent to others. And I think that's Jonah's case.
You write the following about surfing, page 166. Surfers rode waves which were already beautiful, but skateboarders made things beautiful. The ugly discarded nooks and leftovers of a place, the abandoned, unused architecture that people preferred to ignore, beneath their wheels, these dead places became sites of wonder. I'm wondering if you could comment on skateboarding as, I guess, a major part of the book, but more on also the parallel you might be able to draw between skateboarding and writing. Is that your new skateboarding?
Absolutely. I mean, really, I mean, I'm certainly not trying to malign surfing in any way. I surf, and I enjoy it. If I could surf all the time, I probably would. It's a beautiful thing to do, and I, you know, it's incredibly spiritual. But I did. I grew up skateboarding, and I couldn't surf because I lived in Thunder Bay, and nor can the majority of marginalized kids, you know, who have taken up skateboarding all over the world and made it so incredibly popular. And so, absolutely, I was drawing a metaphor between writing and skateboarding. And I think particularly, I mean, this may sound funny, but if there was a project for my work, which, you know, would be difficult for me to actually, you know, sign off on, sort of a thesis statement for my work, it would be this, in a way. I mean, I really believe in literature's power to celebrate the things that go ignored and to tell stories that are normally forgotten or normally left buried. And in that way, skateboarding does the same thing. It's an amazing kind of reclamation of public space. You know, skateboarders go out into this sort of concrete jungle that they're given, and they dance on it. And to me, that is one of the most beautiful things around. And so in a way, I am, you know, it is all the same kind of project, I guess, though I really wouldn't admit it when I'm writing something.
Thanks very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Michael Christie holds a Master's of Fine Arts degree from the University of British Columbia. He was formerly a sponsored skateboarder and traveled throughout the world skateboarding and writing for skateboard magazines. Michael was born in Thunder Bay, Ontario, but now lives on Galliano Island with his wife and two sons. You can find him online at michaelchristie.net.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.